This is Hear Me Out. I'm your host, Celeste Headley. If you're an American who eats food, you probably know it is really, 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 really hard to avoid sugar in this country. It is ubiquitous, it's addictive, and for the government, it is very lucrative. Every few years, the Farm Bill is up for renewal in our legislature. This is one of those years, and so it's time to talk about sugar. The U.S. has a complicated system of incentives that altogether make American sugar artificially expensive. That benefits domestic sugar producers, of course, so the question is, do we need to be doing this? Is it actually better for the average consumer?
There are other countries that actually have no sugar program in place. They don't engage in these kind of shenanigans, and their sugar supply seems to be just fine.
Colin Grabo of the Cato Institute joins us in just a moment. Stay with us.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley. So for a short time here, I have another podcast available too. It is a limited series called Big Sugar from iHeart Podcasts and Imagine Media. It's a deep dive into the secretive multi-billion dollar sugar industry, and it exposes the exploitation and lies that are inside every sweet spoonful that we add to our coffee. You can find Big Sugar wherever you listen, and I obviously encourage you to do that. But we thought this would actually be a good opportunity to introduce you to an unpopular idea in this country, that consuming sugar isn't just bad for your health. It's also bad for the economy and for our government, that in short, sugar is, well, kind of bad. The American government has subsidized and supported the sugar industry since we became a republic. But the way we do it now looks to a lot of people like government overreach. And at worst, some people think it looks a lot like we're propping up a cartel. Colin Grabo is a research fellow at the Cato Institute, and he focuses on trade protectionism issues like the sugar program. So Colin, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Celeste.
So I got to start first with your, I guess we would call it an unpopular opinion. And let me begin with the headline to this piece that you published in 2018. It was called Candy-Coated Cartel, Time to Kill the U.S. Sugar Program. That word cartel, why are you using it to describe the sugar program?
Well, I think it's a very accurate term. A cartel is a small group of businesses that act in concert to restrict competition and keep prices high. And that's exactly what the U.S. sugar program is. It is a government program designed to restrict competition and keep sugar prices high to the detriment of American consumers.
Okay, so I think that what might surprise people here is that in a capitalist system such as ours, businesses are not supposed to be working in concert to keep prices high. They're supposed to be competing with one another. Why do you say that these sugar industries, these businesses are working together?
Well, basically they have the U.S. government functioning. You know, the problem with cartels is coordinating to make sure no one's cheating and everyone's on the same page. Well, the U.S. government serves that role for them. By ensuring that no one, you know, produces too much sugar so you can keep the prices high. People overproduce and the price goes down. And the government helps keep foreign sugar from coming into the country. So all this is designed to ensure, to restrict supplies and keep prices high to the benefit of sugar producers in this country.
Okay, so, I mean, what bothers you about this particular industry? I mean, there are certainly plenty of problems with a lack of competition in the United States. What makes sugar so egregious to you?
I just think on the face of it, it's just when it comes to, you know, free traders like myself and we complain about things, this really stands out for the role that not only is the government, you know, failing to promote competition. It's just actively restricting it. I mean, that is the entire point of this program, is to keep to reduce competition, keep prices elevated. And, you know, we American consumers pay the price. We all use sugar. Sugar goes into so many of the products we consume, as I'm sure you'll explore in your program. And this is basically a program that tries to keep consumers poor so a select, you know, group of producers can be richer. And I just find that, frankly, obscene.
Okay, but you wouldn't argue that this started out from a good place, would you? I mean, the purpose in the beginning was to help U.S. farmers, right?
It helps them at the expense of the rest of us. So I think when it comes to, you know, policy, we should promote competition. I also, you know, starting from a first principle standpoint, I believe in freedom. And I think if I want to buy sugar from someone in Australia or Brazil or India, well, that's my business. And that's something I should be allowed to do. And I shouldn't be punished for it by the U.S. government. Frankly, it's none of their business.
So you're saying that I can't, if I am a candy maker, let's say I decide to make Celeste Headley taffy, I can't buy sugar from somebody in Australia?
You can, but you have to pay an extremely high price. The way this works is the government lets a certain amount of sugar come into the country in a low tariff, about half a penny per pound. But then after that amount is reached, and it's always reached, any sugar import after that has to pay about, I think, something like 15 cents per pound. For perspective, sugar in the international market typically goes for, you know, maybe 25 cents a pound. So it's a severe tariff, and no one in their right mind would pay that. So it effectively places it off limits.
Okay. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to understand is if this is as bad as you say, how would it continue to run? I mean, it's part of the farm bill. People vote for it. It has to be reauthorized every 5 years. Clearly, you know, the Congress people who vote for it every year aren't, you know, somehow not seeing it in the farm bill every year. There must be a reason why it's in there. And that reason must be because it provides jobs, because it is an important part of our economy. No?
No, I would take issue with that. What this does is, you know, obviously I've talked about the consumer angle and how we all pay more. But also, I think you even mentioned earlier, people that produce candy, people that produce baked goods, all kinds of industries use sugar as an input. So if they have to pay higher costs, that means reduced sales, that means lost jobs. So we're killing jobs elsewhere in the economy at the expense of these sugar jobs. You know, as for why this persists, you know, in the face of, I think, overwhelming evidence that it's bad policy, you have to keep in mind that the Farm Bill does lots of things. The Farm Bill does not just cover the sugar program. So if the sugar program, I think, had to stand alone and just came up for a bill by itself and for a straight up or down vote, I think there's a good chance it would go down. But it's tied in with so many other things. There's a lot of log rolling, and you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I leave the sugar program alone, and you leave my favorite pet project alone. A few years ago, John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, wrote his memoir, and he had an anecdote about the sugar program. And he said that he always thought it was ridiculous, but he never spent much time opposing it because he just thought the prospects for victory were so slim. But one day he was walking back to his office and he spotted a sugar lobbyist hanging around. And he just said out loud, something to the effect of, the sugar program is so ridiculous, we absolutely should get rid of it. Well, he said, of course, the next thing that happened is that the sugar lobbyist, of course, overheard it. He starts making phone calls and he said, Boehner, my phone did not stop ringing for the next 5 weeks. I had no idea how many people in my district were connected to the sugar industry. People were calling all day telling me how they made this or that related to the sugar production process and how many jobs were on the line. And he said, that's why, you know, his quote was, that's why you don't F with big sugar. I think this has a lot of explanatory power. Your average American, they pay more for sugar. How much more? You know, it's, I think some estimates show $10 or $11. So, you know, for a family of four, we're talking, you know, $40, $50 a year. That's not the kind of thing that you're going to march on Congress with, you know, pitchforks and torches. But of course, the people that profit from this collect, you know, $10 per 330 million Americans. That's a decent chunk of change. And they're very invested in keeping this in place. So we have a dynamic where the people that profit from this, that make that extra money, they're very invested in making sure the program stays, and they donate accordingly, and they employ lobbyists accordingly. Whereas your average American, they're not even aware that this is going on. And so I think our politics and the policy that we see reflects those dynamics.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I have a lot of questions, not surprisingly, but we're going to take a break. We're talking about whether or not the sugar industry, all of the various sugar companies, are a sugar cartel. And we're talking about it with somebody who is from the conservative Cato Institute, and so I would expect to be in support of big business, Colin Grabow. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headley. We'll be back in just a moment.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
And we're back. This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headley, and we're talking about the U.S. Sugar Program. It's part of the Farm Bill, a massive bill that comes up for reauthorization every 5 years, and it is up for reauthorization this year. And Colin Grabow, who is with the Cato Institute, says it's time to kill the part of the Farm Bill that relates to U.S. sugar. And the reason for this, Colin says, is because the U.S. sugar program is basically a cartel. And we talked a little bit before the break, Colin, about the fact that it's the sugar producers in this country are basically joined together to keep our prices high.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. And you said that it's keeping it high in the grocery stores. But we're also, as taxpayers, subsidizing it. Are we not? Like, that's what the Farm Bill is all about.
The Farm Bill gives out, yeah, subsidizes lots of crops. And I think the sugar program is basically, it's an indirect subsidy. It it ensures that prices for sugar have a certain floor. They, you know, it gives them a certain minimum price they know that they'll get, that they, you know, the price won't fall below. So they have a certainty that the bare minimum they're going to get, you know, a certain price for their for the sugar they produce.
But that, you know, one of the big arguments every single time this comes around is that the purpose of those subsidies is price stabilization. Do you not buy the idea? You know, one of the things that you even quote in your report from 2018 was a letter saying that we have to avoid the wild price swings of the so-called free market.
Yeah, you know, sugar producers, they like having a steady, predictable prices for their sugar, and of course they do. That's nice to have, but why should I, you know, why should the rest of us pay the price so that they can have that predictability? If they don't like the business, if they don't like the volatility, then get out and find a new line of work. This is not unique to them. Lots of companies, lots of industries in this country have to deal with volatile prices, you know, try being in the energy industry, for example. But, you know, these contribute to more efficient markets and lower prices. And ultimately, I think that's what matters at the end of the day. You know, I don't think we should set our policies for the convenience of the country's businesses. It should be the benefit of our consumers. And people should be able, you know, to compete. It's all about competition. And if you're not up for it, then, you know, I'm sorry. I think you should find, again, a new line of work.
But, you know, there were rationalizations for this program when it first began. And one of them was that we didn't want to have to rely on sugar coming from outside our borders, right? That we wanted to always have a source for sugar that was right here within the continental United States. And therefore, we didn't want to drive all of our sugar producers out of the kitchen just in case we at some point ended up at war. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, so when it comes to something like the sugar program, I think for neutral observers, most people think it's pretty absurd. It's a program that its entire purpose is to artificially inflate the price of sugar. So in the face of this, people that support the sugar program have to come up with some, I'd say, pretty inventive reasons, some pretty imaginative justifications to keep this law, this program in place. And one justification we've heard, I know that it's been made by Senator Marco Rubio, among others, is that essentially, well, you know, if we didn't have the sugar program, then we wouldn't produce our own sugar. And then we're beholden to other countries, and those sugar fields, you know, they'd get paved over and turned into, you know, strip malls or condominiums or, you know, what have you. And then we can't feed ourselves, and, you know, essentially we're screwed and we're beholden to other countries. I take a very skeptical view of such arguments. The idea that we are in danger of, say, Brazil or Australia or India cutting off sugar to the United States, saying, we don't want your money anymore. Don't give us money. We're not interested in exchanging, you know, sugar for money. I find that laughable, frankly. And then we also have to acknowledge that there are other countries that actually, you know, have no sugar program in place, that they don't engage in these kind of shenanigans, and their sugar supply seems to be just fine. In fact, there are countries that not only they don't have these kinds of programs, they still produce sugar. So this idea that we need these programs and otherwise we won't produce sugar, I think is absurd. The United States is an agricultural powerhouse for good reason. We're big. We have a good climate, good soil. The idea that we would be in danger of not being able to feed ourselves or being beholden to, you know, shadowy or evil foreign interests, I find this kind of laughable and just a tribute to the kind of leaps of logic one must make to try to justify this program.
Do you find it odd that this puts you at odds with people like Marco Rubio and other people, other conservatives who are really strongly in support of the U.S. sugar program and feel that it's a really important program that supports, like I said, job creators, economic drivers for the United States?
Well, here at the Cato Institute, we consider ourselves libertarian, and we don't take any partisan affiliation. And oftentimes, we find ourselves aligning with, you know, Democrats on one issue, Republicans on another issue.
Yeah.
And I don't really, you know, care who my views offend or are in line with or not in line with. It's, does this make sense or doesn't it make sense? And I think when it comes to the sugar program, it absolutely does not make sense. Our Republicans, if you listen to the rhetoric, and a lot of it's about freedom and competition, but they don't really walk that line, you know, when it comes to policy. Sugar program being one example. Rubio, as someone that, you know, at least in the past, has endorsed, you know, free market and competition, increasingly less so, you know, he supports the sugar program, and I can't think it's helped tied to the fact that, you know, Florida produces a quarter of the country's sugar, and the sugar interests there, they donate accordingly, and they cultivate, you know, politicians and try to spread their views and have them share their perspective on things. You find this, you know, dynamic, of course, it's not unique to sugar. And I just think that, you know, I actually believe some of that rhetoric the Republicans, you know, at least used to espouse, that, you know, competition, the free market makes us more prosperous, makes us better off. And I think that this kind of protectionism hurts consumers, especially the poor, who, you know, disproportionately consume, you know, food takes up more of their budget, a percentage of their budget than your average family. And so I think it's bad policy. And I think it's also just morally kind of wrong when you also factor in those kind of considerations, like who's paying the bill here.
So I'm so glad that you brought up food, the food end of this, because we've been talking about the economics of this so far, but I do want to talk about food, but we do have to take one more quick break. We are talking to Colin Grabo. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headley, and we'll be back in just one moment. We are back. I am talking with Colin Grabo of the Cato Institute, and we're talking about sugar. Is it bad for our economy, at least when it comes to the U.S. sugar program, those big subsidies that end up going to sugar producers here in the United States? Is it a bad deal for us, not only in terms of the subsidies that go to sugar producers, but then the price that we pay in grocery stores? But then, Colin, I want to talk about not just what we pay if we pick up a bag of sugar in our grocery store, but I wonder what you think about how much sugar ends up in our food itself. Even if this isn't part of the farm bill, I just want to sound out your opinions on the way sugar ends up in so much of our food. Do you consider that to be sort of part of the overall landscape when it comes to sugar? The fact that it's now in bread and beef jerky, like there's sugar in pretty much everything?
So, you know, I don't take a strong opinion on that. You know, to me, that's up to, you know, food producers, what they want to make and, you know, what ingredients they want to use. And consumers, of course, can buy that or healthy alternatives. I prefer the healthier stuff, although I do have the occasional sweet tooth. But, you know, when it comes to the sugar program, of course, it raises the cost of sugar, which is a disincentive to use sugar. But let's not think that all of a sudden that means people use healthier ingredients. Take, you know, Coca-Cola, for example, and other soft drinks. Price of sugar is high. So instead they use, you know, high fructose corn syrup. And corn, of course, is something we subsidize. So this is, you know, a situation here where we make sugar expensive, so they switch over to subsidized corn. Now, is using high fructose corn syrup instead of sugar, you know, a win for American diets? I'm no expert on dieting and you know, healthy food habits, but I'm skeptical, at least, of that idea that this is a net win for Americans, that we're better off. And I think it's notable that, you know, in this country that we import, you know, Coke from Mexico. Why? You know, because it has actual sugar in it, whereas the Coke, you know, we're the country that invented Coke, and yet we use, you know, high fructose corn syrup instead because we subsidize corn and we make sugar, you know, artificially more expensive. So I think ultimately people's, you know, sweet tooth has not gone away. People want sugar, and either they're going to pay more for it, or, you know, food producers are going to find other ways to satisfy that need. They're going to use other ingredients that, you know, still have that same sweetness that consumers are looking for.
So do you think the U.S. government should be subsidizing any foods?
Absolutely not. No, no. The corn program, I mean, in my world, there would be no, farm bill. We wouldn't be, subsidizing, the different crops and saying, okay, you get this much, you get that much. And, we think that this is worth promoting. No, let's let the market decide and farmers can, fight it out in the marketplace.
And if farmers can't compete in the marketplace and the United States doesn't have enough farms and food producers?
That we import from other countries. And, we want to take our farms and say, I want to start a manufacturing plant here instead and sell, we end up selling more computer chips instead of potato chips. That's fine with me. Look at countries like, Iceland. Iceland is no agricultural powerhouse. No one there is in danger of starvation because, they produce other things and they import the things that they need. And you can find, of course, examples of that all across the globe.
On the other hand, the population of Iceland is less than 400,000 people, and the population of the United States is far more than that.
Well, fortunately, we also have a much bigger country than Iceland and much more arable land, and I don't think that's going away anytime soon. So I'm pretty confident we'll be okay.
So you don't think at all there's a public good in ensuring that the United States would be able to support its population with food, the government ensuring that?
Yeah, I think the best way the government can ensure that we have sufficient food supplies and they're affordable and adequate is to get out of the market. Because as we see with the sugar program, when they start meddling with things, I like the outcomes are pro-consumer. And remember, it takes to hand out these subsidies, well, that money has to come from somewhere. So we're taking money out of people's pockets and then handing it back to the consumers. Then we say, well, it's okay, consumers. That just means your food's cheaper. Well, frankly, I'd rather have the extra money in my pocket. And I think that I'll be able to afford food just fine.
And frankly, the food, when it comes to sugar, at least, the food is not cheaper. Sugar here is much more expensive than it is in the rest of the world. That's for sure.
No argument from me.
Okay. So to be totally clear, you don't support programs that, I guess, support farmers.
To be totally clear, I don't support punishing, taxpayers to fork over money to our country's farmers. A lot of these are huge agribusinesses. They're for-profit corporations, and, I don't get to share in their profits. I don't see why I should have to subsidize their production. So, yeah, just very fundamentally, I think that, I believe in the marketplace, and I think they're entitled to those profits, but I think they're also, they don't need a helping hand from me either.
So I want to read you, as I mentioned earlier on, I hosted an investigative journalism podcast called Big Sugar, and we got a response from the trade organization that represents the sugar industry. They said, this industry is 100% farmer and employee and family owned. It employs 100% union skilled labor. All the sugar industry pays fair wages and offers good benefits to their workers. This podcast maligns 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane family farmers who support 151,000 jobs across more than 24 states. I feel like that response would also refer to you. We provide high quality sugar to American consumers every day. What would be your response to this? They're basically saying, the money we're getting from the American public is going to a good cause.
Well, going to a good cause, that portrays them as some kind of charity. Well, they're a business. They're out to make money, which is what they do. And I just think that they should compete. It is a business. It's not a charity. And if they are out there producing, great quality sugar at a good price, people will continue to buy it. And when they go to the government and say, no, we need help, they basically say, we're not good enough. We're inferior to the competition out there. Well, why should I support that? Also point out that, if we did have the sugar program, I'm sure we would buy more foreign sugar. How much more? I don't know. But it would come from places like, India and Brazil. These are developing countries. They could use jobs there, too. And, if we want to talk about promoting, helping, people genuinely in need, and developing countries, well, let's open up our markets to them and let them sell us their products. So I don't think that these folks are a charity case. And if they want to collect donations from people, if people, you know, feel free to donate to them and write checks, they're more than, they should absolutely be able to do that. But this is a market. And if they have a good product at a good price, people will buy it.
I mean, this isn't about subsidies, but I have to ask a question sitting here in what's basically kind of a climate change hellscape. I have to ask about the limits of the free market, which is that we do need regulations for sure. I mean, somebody has to be overseeing them. And again, you've only been talking about subsidies, but how much can we rely on the free market when it comes to some of these producers, and when it comes to the best choices in terms of our farming?
Yeah, well, you know, another critique of the sugar producers that I don't think we've gotten into a bit is the environmental one. Florida produces something like a quarter of the country's sugar, and a lot of that comes from the greater Everglades region. So we're encouraging the production of sugar in an environmentally sensitive area. And of course, that leads to, you know, runoff from the fertilizer that's used. And then when, you know, sugar cane is harvested, they burn the fields to eliminate the leafy outer shell or husk of the cane sugar to get to it. That produces, you know, smoke that goes in nearby communities. So if we, you know, want to get serious about helping our environment, well, one thing we should do is stop subsidizing the people that are polluting it. That seems to me to be a logical, you know, starting place. I mean, I would hope that's something we could all agree on, no matter what our, you know, outlook or ideology. That's also worth bearing in mind in this conversation, I think.
Do you eat a lot of sugar? I mean, I know you said that you try to defer to healthy eating, but do you consume a lot? Do you feel like you have a sweet tooth?
I try to stay away from it. The best thing is, you know, just don't buy it when you go to the grocery store so it's not there at home to tempt me. But, you know, sometimes the kids, it's a hot day, they want to go out for ice cream. So I'm not going to say no to that. I have to confess, you know, next week I'm going to Spain for a month where my wife is from. And there's a lot of chocolate on offer there, you know, the baked goods, and it's hard to say
that
no.
May not be American sugar in Spain, though.
That's right. No, it will not be American sugar in Spain. That's right. It might be, you know, Brazilian or from some other place. Although other than Europeans are totally guilt-free when it comes to subsidies and protectionism of their agricultural markets.
I mean, I will have to say, you know, during the recording of the podcast, I will say that going without sugar is not easy. It's rarely called sugar. And it's in everything.
Yes.
It's in everything. Colin Grabo, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Well, Celeste, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
All right. I know that all of you have some thoughts about sugar, especially if you, like me, have ever tried to go without it. Luckily, it's really easy to let us know what you think. You can just email us. It's hearmeout@slate.com. Lots of you have already done that. Last week, we had Kristen Meinzer on the show to make a case for not just caring about Meghan Markle, but defending her. We got so much listener mail about this. So much. But we have time to share just one letter right now. And we want to share one that we got from a listener named Sarah. Sarah wrote this. Thank you so much for the You Need to Care About Meghan Markle episode. You summed up so many of my thoughts. I'm so tired of the she should have known attitude. As a mixed race person myself, who is also white presenting, I feel like I understand her situation all too well. Just because we were white enough to get a seat at the table doesn't make it any less painful when we aren't white enough to stay for dessert. We do our best to judge our company, but we can't always predict racism. It can rear its head anywhere. Thank you for setting the record straight. Oh, Sarah, white enough to stay for dessert. I freaking love that metaphor. We cover a lot of challenging opinions here, and we are sure that you have your own takes, and we love hearing them. So please email us. It's hearmeout@slate.com. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is VP of Slate Audio. I'm your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotarucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.